Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcast. This is podcast 369 post-dinner. So you might be hearing some planes swing by over the bunker as we speak, although it will be very subtle in this podcast because I still have to have the windows closed because it's very wet and rainy and cool outside. But here's some of the stuff I want to talk about in this podcast. First of all, you have the Amtrak train crash in Philadelphia. And the fact that before anybody knows what happened in the crash, you have the people who believe that we have to build infrastructure in this country screaming and yelling and pounding about infrastructure. If we had built infrastructure, this wouldn't be happening, and those evil Republicans don't want to do that. Speaking of evil Republicans, Jeb Bush keeps trying to answer a question he should not have tried to answer in the first place, and I'm going to tell you why. There was a protest in Minneapolis the other night, and I'll tell you what it was, what sparked it. But it was an unannounced protest in which a 10-year-old kid was part of the protest and got gassed by the police. And we're going to talk about that. What else? ABC's George Stephanopoulos forgot to mention that he gave the Clinton Foundation it was $75,000 at the last count, kind of shades of Brian Williams. Well, you know, I was under fire. Well, I guess I was. I'm not sure. I don't remember. Anyway, George Stephanopoulos, who works, you know, he's an ABC News guy, interviewed Peter Schweitzer, who is the guy who wrote the tell-all book about Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton's global initiative and how much money it takes in. And Stephanopoulos, you know, is supposed to be an objective journalist, but he gave the foundation $75,000. And really, nothing more needs to be said about this story. I'm just going to let that one kind of hang there because there doesn't need to be any more details about it. It's just another sad example of how bankrupt the mainstream media is when it comes to covering the news. And the Pope is at it again, and he's waving the red flag. So we'll talk about that and a bunch of other stuff in this podcast, podcast 369, to get you ready for the weekend. As you know, the Podcast Mobile Command Unit, which I refer to as Podcast Mobile Command Unit 8, the ambulance, is quietly waiting to be brought into use. It is standing by in its revetment at an RV park around here. And I can tell you that for sure I'm going to be at the Iowa straw poll on August 8th of this year. Jeb Bush is not going to be there, but I'll be there. That'll probably be the first big political event that I cover. And I can also tell you that I will be at the Eau Claire Air Show, which is at the end of July. And then I'm probably going to be at a couple of these different car shows around town. I got to get the ambulance all shined up, but I should mention that it came from exgovernmentcars.com. And I think a lot of you that listen to the podcast know that I went to Ed originally and I said, I want to get a van. And he was like, don't get a van, get an ambulance. And so exgovernmentcars.com is kind of the de facto sponsor of Mobile Podcast Command. And I should mention that I am collecting cash for diesel fuel. So if you donate, all the money is going directly into the fund, the PayPal account that is used only for Mobile Podcast Command. So I got a picture of Mobile Podcast Command up on the BobDavisPodcast.com, and you can donate, and I'm saving that money for diesel fuel. So I would have mentioned that right up front. But I also got to tell you that the ex-government cars grand reopening event is on. Now, Ed was going to move, then he ended up buying the building, and so they're doing a grand reopening event. And the main thing that I want to tell you, and that Ed wants to tell you, is that these ex-government cars are kick-ass. I've had three Crown Vics. They're great cars, but he also has nicer, newer vehicles because he knows now where to go to get the good cars. Chargers, Impalas, next-gen Fords, which is the new Ford Police sedan, and eventually the Ford Police SUV, which is awesome, plus trucks, vans, and SUVs. He had an E350 down there. He has Yukons, you know, whatever you need. The main thing also is, in addition to great vehicles, great financing for all levels of credit, so it doesn't matter. The good, the bad, and the ugly, everybody gets approved. Ex-government cars only carries one owner, professionally maintained government and fleet vehicles, and it's really important important because this is why they are so kick-ass, because they've been maintained and then they get them all ready to sell them to you. So let's review very quickly. OnlyXGovernmentCars.com has it all. First of all, cash deals directly from owner Ed Johnson. So, you know, go talk to Ed, see what he can do for you. Two, a three-day satisfaction guarantee. If you don't like the car, bring it back. Three, financing for all levels of credit, and you can apply safely and securely online 24/7 at XGovernmentCars.com, or you can go out there, 2420 Nevada Avenue South in Golden Valley, Minnesota. And I'm going to add one more thing. For the life of your car, they'll give you advice and help you out and give you information, and they know a lot about these cars. So don't ever forget that. And go see what they've got. If you're in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, check them out, xgovernmentcars.com, 2420 Nevada Avenue North in Golden Valley, Minnesota. And don't forget the grand reopening event is on now. Everything is better at
xgovernmentcars.com.
So I want to start with the big train crash outside of Philadelphia. We know that the train was going over 100 miles an hour through a city, and I am told, and I think this is really an important piece, I did not read this in the news, but I am told that when it comes to trains, the big freight trains out west, that anything over 80, even out west in those really wide open spaces where you can often see, you know, you'll see a train coming around a bend and the back of the train is way up in the mountains and the bottom of the train is down below in the valley. Those trains don't go over 80 miles an hour. That's considered dangerous with the big freight trains. So 100 miles an hour is beyond excessive. Because the freight trains, when they're hauling ass, are going 80. So if I had to guess at the cause of a train accident, I can tell you that it wasn't and wouldn't be and probably won't be infrastructure. Vox and the Democrats say this because there are systems that can supposedly, and I say that supposedly is really important, to be put in place on railroad tracks, and they are controversial because supposedly they prevent this kind of accident from occurring. They're in different locations, supposedly. They're not in this particular area. So suddenly that means our nation's infrastructure is crumbling. Now, this is going to be a big campaign issue in 2016. It's all about inequality, and we're not putting enough money in and investing enough money in the country's infrastructure. And it's nonsense. First of all, the U.S. should sell Amtrak. Our government has no business in the train business whatsoever. Passenger rail is a money loser. It will always be a money loser. It has been a money loser, at least as far as I can tell, since the 1950s, and maybe before that. The idea of passenger rails, and a lot of people don't know this, but if you just a light study of the railroad business, will tell you that the reason that they started to put money into passenger trains was really a promotion so that businessmen would use trains to haul freight. And the idea that freight trains would compete with other types of freight services. And that is the reason that passenger rails were so fantastic back in the day. That's one of the main reasons. They started losing money almost as soon as aviation appeared, and they would have started losing money a lot earlier, but World War II intervened. And as air travel got better and better and better over the years, it literally killed passenger trains because companies couldn't even afford to run passenger trains to promote freight rails. All cities had to do, if they wanted an airport, was maintain one airport. Planes can fly anywhere. They can be serviced anywhere. They're easier to service. They're not as complex as trains, and there's no tracks that have to be maintained. So from that moment on, passenger rail service was doomed. It will never come back, but it doesn't prevent these romanticists who are train freaks from believing that we're just $1 billion away from having this amazing passenger rail service in this country. The country is just simply too large. Planes are too efficient, and we will never, ever have an efficient passenger rail service that can take people across the country reasonably cheaply, not to mention the time factor. They will always, 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 always lose money. Passenger rails in any way, shape, or form, commuter rails, the CTA, the Metro, and of course, light rail, they all lose money, and they don't do what they say that they're going to do. And the reality is, for the subsidy that we give Amtrak, the government could actually buy all the passengers on Amtrak airplane tickets, and it would be cheaper. There's only one line that I know of that is quote unquote profitable. And this is a sale from New York City to D.C., which is, of course, where the corridor was where this crash happened. Now, I don't know if this was in a sale train, but I'll tell you something else that I do know. I know that back in the day, the Amtrak, when there was a problem, would charge off tracks and maintenance issues to the old Conrail system, which was the government train company that later became BNSF. So the thing has lost money since the beginning. And what the government should do is simply sell it. And if they do, even if they sell it and it's profitable, I guarantee you that it will close within a matter of years, because ultimately, no matter what you do and how many people ride it, it will lose money. So it's time to get rid of trains, and it's certainly time to get rid of the government involvement in trains. You know, if there's a commercial reason why somebody could get into the train business and make money doing it, they will do it. Second, infrastructure investment does not improve the economy. It creates only a small band of jobs, if that. The government, when it spends money on infrastructure, cannot simply spend money on the infrastructure. It has to give the money to the states. We saw this with the American Reinvestment Act, which was the big stimulus package, where they simply could not spend all the money. My favorite stories about that are they gave all this money to the National Guard and military in individual states, and they ended up building new latrines because they didn't know what to do with the money. So the shovel-ready project thing was supposed to get, quote-unquote, jumpstart the economy. It simply did not have that effect. We are now pouring billions across this country into train projects and things of that nature rather than the kind of infrastructure we need, which is roads and bridges, because the biggest problem that we have in this country is the difficulties getting, goods and services across metropolitan areas. So it's a trucking problem. Secondly, if you really wanted to spend money on infrastructure, you would build the Keystone Pipeline, for example. So I think that's really an important thing to point out. Infrastructure investment very seldom improves the economy. Now, it is true that government spending is a part of the GDP calculation, but so the idea is if we spend money, it will improve the GDP, but it doesn't work. It's not working in China. It did not work in Europe. It's not working anywhere. It certainly didn't work in Japan, which has spent literally trillions of yen to build up its infrastructure, and their economy has yet to recover from this. This is a misguided policy, and people need to know this. And what's happening is they're using a tragedy again to get a policy passed because they think people will be scared because they're going to hold these politicians responsible for the deaths of these poor people on this Amtrak plane. Now on to Jeb Bush, because I don't want to waste too much time on the Amtrak story because it's a no-brainer. About a week ago, the former Florida governor was on some, I think it was Fox, waxing poetic, as he likes to do, when somebody asked him whether he would have supported an invasion of Iraq if he had been president back in 2003 or whenever it started. And stupidly, he answered the question, you know, just without even, in my view, thinking. Today, he said, he's been trying to walk back his comments all week, and they call this evolving comments, which I love. Today, he said, knowing what he knows now, he would have said no. And all the other Republican candidates slammed their foreheads with the palms of their hands when they heard Bush's remarks the first time, saying, what an idiot. Of course we wouldn't have invaded Iraq if we knew what we knew now. Well, of course we wouldn't have, right? And my response to that is, first of all, yes, you would have, because you wouldn't know what you know now. Because this was a product of a foreign policy mostly concerned about eliminating the 9/11 style threat that pretty much included anybody in the Middle East with the average American who didn't differentiate between an Iraqi and an Afghani and so forth. Many of us believed it. I believed it. And I'm certainly not going to change my spots now. I did a whole podcast about it. The other thing, and I don't think that that Jeb Bush spent enough time on this, but the fact is that some of the policy failure regarding Iraq is the president's problem, because President Obama did not, the people need to understand that when Bush left office, the Iraq situation was under control. And it was the precipitous withdrawal that had as much to do with what is going on in Iraq today as really the invasion in the first place. And that's where much of the focus should be. Secondly, Bush should have said, instead of answering the question, he should have said, well, here's what I would do. I would redirect you to ask Hillary Clinton that question since she voted for it. Now, he did say that, but he didn't say it properly. And he also should have said, and ask my brother that question because he also ordered it. And then as far as what he would have done, he should have said, first of all, I wasn't there. In other words, I wasn't in office, so it's an idiotic question to ask me. And the real question ought to be, what is your foreign policy going to be? Well, of course, he can't answer that question because he doesn't have a foreign policy. None of the Republicans have one. And the rest of these idiots all chimed in with their he's wrong statements, and they don't have any kind of a foreign policy issue, and they all missed it. First of all, it's too late to cry over spilt milk. The other thing is, you know, we are going to have to develop a foreign policy that takes into account the fact that the United States is now the world's largest swing oil producer. We are the largest oil producer in the United States, in the world. And the whole situation that existed back in 2003, 10 years ago, no longer exists, and it's significantly different. So the oil production question is going to significantly change the U.S. involvement in the Middle East in the future, because we don't need to be there for any reason. Secondly, I question the idea, and it made sense to me in 2003, and I'm just saying that. And I felt that, in fact, I think I said at the time, this is the last chance they're going to get. This is the last chance that these people are ever going to get to straighten out their countries. And that was for the United States to invade and basically try to graft a democratic republic onto the, into the most advanced country in the region at the time, which is Iraq. You know, Iraq had Western universities. It was the most educated and most advanced country in the Middle East at the time. And the idea was that we were going to invade it, we were going to fix it, and it was going to be, you know, like France when it was all over. It was going to be like Algeria when it was all over, except that's not what happened. And you know, I think we need a new school of foreign policy. We need a new policy that's based on the realistic situation. I can't tell you what it is. I couldn't possibly approach it in one podcast. I've thought a lot about it, but I don't think that we need to sacrifice, you know, any more Americans for what is going on over there unless we're actually protecting our own interests. And I'll leave it at that. But I don't think any of these candidates have any idea what U.S. foreign policy should be. And I think they should just say it. I think they should just say, you know, we're going to have to develop a new foreign policy because we don't really have one that's effective. I mean, in short, I got a little bit of time, so I'll just say this. You know, the foreign policy that we're currently working off of is kind of the post-Cold War foreign policy. So at the very, you know, at the beginning of the Reagan administration, the United States basically challenged Russia to an arms race. And the reason for that is we knew that we had a stronger economy than they did and that we would be able to have essentially guns and butter. So by invigorating the U.S. military in the 1980s, and by deploying the Peacemaker MX missiles, and by improving the submarine fleet, and by building the B-1 and the F-16 and the F-15, etc., Ronald Reagan pushed the Russians into a situation where they could not compete, and it destroyed the Russian economy. That's primarily what happened in that period of time. And I think probably Reagan and his advisors knew that eventually the Soviet Union would end up on the ash heap of history. When they succeeded, that was when they started to try to figure out how to develop a new foreign policy. But nobody knew what to do about it. You might recall it was called How Do We Spend the Peace Dividend? And Clinton's answer to that was to use it for social programs and things of that nature. And things were good, but we never really developed a new foreign policy. All through the Clinton administration, we really didn't have a foreign policy. We kind of continued the old Cold War policy by working within the Cold War structures, the United Nations, NATO, things of that nature. And the only real foreign policy challenge that Clinton had was the situation in Kosovo and Serbia during his administration. So there were a couple of other minor, and I can't think of them all now, but basically he didn't have that many challenges because the Soviet Union was out of the mix and they were really the largest bad actor. But what was happening was that things were reforming and and we were entering an era of a multipolar foreign situation as opposed to a bipolar foreign situation. And the only guy that really talked about it was Henry Kissinger in the book Diplomacy, and very few people read it, and nobody paid any attention to it. And so we never really developed a new foreign policy. Well, that all ended on 9/11, and we have yet to develop a new foreign policy. We are in a defensive crouch related to the attacks on 9/11, but the policymakers, in other words, the politicians, really have never developed a new foreign policy. They talked about a reset to Russia. They talked about, you know, a reset to Asia, pivots, and all this other stuff. But there is no new foreign policy school that says, here's what we're going to do, like as in a containment policy to the Soviet Union with, I think it was George Kennan that developed that. So we don't really have a foreign policy in this country. And none of the Republicans have a foreign policy, and none of the Democrats have a foreign policy. And certainly the president of the United States really doesn't have a foreign policy. So we're kind of adrift on this issue. The one thing we have learned is invading and fixing the country is probably not a good idea. It probably doesn't work. So now what? And I would just leave it to everybody else. We're going to all, as citizens, have to start thinking about what kind of foreign policy we believe we should have. You know, you have candidates already saying things like, we need to go over, you know, McCain and, you know, Scott Walker and others. We need to take the fight to ISIS. Well, you know, that's not going to work. We're not going to be able to take the fight to ISIS because the causes of ISIS, as I outlined in another podcast, are not addressable by quote unquote sending troops to Iraq, because you're just going to have the same kind of problem again. So the problem is a foreign policy. And this is why Bush blew it, because what he should have simply said was, you know, it's too late to cry over spilt milk. We can't answer that question because I wasn't there. I couldn't have told you what I did because I wasn't serving at the time. I wasn't in the Senate and I wasn't in the House. You need to direct that question to someone that was. And he should have just said, I'm just not going to answer the question because you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. So he answered the question by saying, I would have invaded Iraq. And then a week later, now he says he wouldn't have. So now all the quote-unquote Republicans who don't have a clue what to do are mad at him, because now he's a flip-flopper. And of course, a week ago, all of the so-called liberals were mad at him. And you know, the media misses the fact. You don't see them asking Hillary Clinton anything because she's hiding. She hasn't been in the media for the last, 30 days. So, you know, it's really unfortunate that I think it's a key thing, and I've yet to hear a Republican outline a foreign policy that makes any sense. So Madison, the most liberal city in the country, probably, where this kind of stuff isn't supposed to happen, has declined to prosecute the police involved in a police shooting of a black kid in Madison a few weeks ago. And so now on Wednesday night in Minneapolis, there was a protest, and apparently it got a little rowdy. Protesters jumping on cars, opening car doors, and trying to pull people out of their cars and so on. I want to point out that the protest, they didn't try to get a permit. They didn't notify the city that they were going to do this. They just went down there and started doing this stuff. And of course, the Minneapolis police moved in aggressively and tried to stop the whole thing by pushing these people back with pepper spray. Now, I want you all to remember that last year during the Ferguson thing, a motorist ran over somebody in the same kind of a protest. So the police are essentially protecting both the protesters and the people who could be potential victims in a case where people are yanking people out of their car. And I would also point out, you know, those protesters are really lucky somebody didn't get shot, because, you know, people are armed, and you run up to somebody and yank open their door without warning, and you don't know what they're going to do. And I would caution people, and I'm not saying you're going to get shot because you're doing this. I'm saying, you know, you can't predict what people are going to do when you're in a protest. If you want to protest peacefully, that's one thing. But if you're going to yank open people's doors and things like that, bad things are going to happen sooner or later. Well, you know, they used pepper spray, and apparently some woman brought her 10-year-old autistic child to the protest, and he ended up getting pepper sprayed. Now, first of all, he's fine. But, you know, I read that story and I thought to myself, what kind of an idiot brings a 10-year-old autistic kid to a protest in downtown Minneapolis after dark, which is pretty late around here? You know, it doesn't even get dark in this area until about 9:30 at this time of the year. Somebody ought to be protesting that. And this brings me up with this whole thing. It was one of the things that bugs me the most, is this idea of bringing kids to protests. Protests can be volatile, especially when they're about volatile issues, number one. Number two, that kid should be free to develop their own ideas about what they think politically. They shouldn't be dragged out to your big event, I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on, and forced to carry some sign that promotes your point of view, whether it's man's inhumanity to man or some shooting or socialism or whatever it is. Leave your kids at home. And, you know, you can talk to them about the protest. You can tell them why you're going out to protest. You can give them your theories and everything else, but you know, this is primarily an adult activity. It is not an activity for children, and I can't believe how really people just lack common sense these days. What else is driving me crazy? As the communist pope embraces his mass murdering friend Raul Castro, the Vatican is issuing a statement that says climate change deniers are all capitalists who don't care about the environment. They just want to make money. I just did a story about how the Catholic Church is losing adherence in droves, and you wonder why. Losing adherence in droves in this country, as well as the Presbyterians and the other mainline faiths, and you wonder why. These organizations, these institutions are moving too far to the left, and people don't like it. What do you think would happen if the pope was a regular guy in Cuba, and he decided to speak out and say what he says about capitalism about the regime in Cuba? Well, he would be in jail, as are most of the 53 dissidents that were quote-unquote let out recently to con Obama into normalizing relations with Castro's down in Cuba. Everybody should read at least some of the accounts of Castro's former bodyguard, who was persecuted, tortured, jailed, and eventually defected to the United States, about how the Supreme Comandante lived like a king while his people starved. These dictators are horrible people. They are horrible for their countries. They are horrible for their people. And to me, it is sacrilege that the Pope would embrace these people, and that François Hollande in France would embrace Raul Castro as though he was some kind of rock star. What is wrong with these guys? Other than the fact that they're simply useful idiots. You know, that's what the Soviets used to call people that made their arguments for them back during the whole era of communism's rise. And that's exactly what the Pope is. It's disgusting. And I can't imagine how Americans can sit in those pews and listen to that hokum, knowing full well that the Pope, who is in charge of their church, would consign them all to the tyranny of communism had he a choice. It's really terrible. And, you know, there's nothing they can do about it because, of course, the Pope isn't voted in by the congregation. He is elected by a bunch of cloistered eunuchs in Rome. Finally, I got to talk about the weather. The trees are full. I just love it. I want to get outside, you know, down in the flat here next door to the right under, you know, right next to the bunker, because I can't wait to get the sound of those trees, you know, on the audio. But it's so wet out there, I can't go out there. But we're supposed to get up here. We're supposed to get into the 80s and thunderstorms this weekend, and I believe the heat is coming. We are on the verge of summer up here in the upper Midwest. I can't believe how thick the trees are. I just can't wait to get out there. And I almost feel like I have to apologize because we're in the studio in this podcast. And while the Vatican is busy telling us about global warming, which, by the way, all the predictions about are wrong and have been wrong, now come the warnings about El Nino. And I want to talk real quick about El Nino. Two things. First, none of the stories that I read actually say what El Ninos do to weather patterns. It would take a paragraph to say what happens in an El Nino. But they just point out that it's a possibility that an El Nino event is forming, and then, you know, Katie bar the door, right? It's scaring people because people read, oh, an El Nino is coming. What exactly does it mean? Well, first of all, you have to read a few of the stories to find out that every national weather service, so if it's Australia, Japan, EU, and the US, all disagree over the so-called constitution of an El Nino event. They all have different data points that they look at. Usually, you can say that an El Nino event is caused by a warming of the water in the Pacific and the air above the water, which then changes the weather patterns. But I had to do a lot of research to find out that the conditions also sometimes dissipate without warning, so you can actually predict an El Nino event that does not happen. So with all these sophisticated instruments, we are unable to predict with any level of accuracy a local, for all intents and purposes, weather event. But we can predict with great accuracy the existence of something called global warming and the effects of it. So what are the effects of an El Nino? Should we actually have one? Well, the last big event for El Nino was in the year 1997 and 98. And it's interesting because, first of all, the effects don't show up until the winter after the onset. Usually that means warmer and drier winters where we live in the upper Midwest, Minneapolis, St. Paul, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, down to Chicago, the Dakotas, you know, and so forth, and kind of the upper West. Because what happens is the jet stream stays up in Canada. So I would also assume that in the lower reaches of the Midwest, Missouri, Iowa, that it will be warm as well. And I'm happy about that because I'm going to be traveling in that region to cover the 2016 election cycle. So I'm hoping that it'll be warm. So while, you know, everybody is screaming about El Nino, nobody actually tells you what the effects are. And it's hard to tell because of the delay, it's hard to tell when the effects will develop. Now, it will mean more storms and rain for California, which, of course, is good because that will mean the end of the drought out there. Sometimes what happens is El Nino suppresses hurricanes on the East Coast, and it means a warmer winter in the Midwest and West, as I said. And it's good for corn, apparently, in the year following. And I'm hoping if we're actually going to have an El Nino that it has an effect on summer this summer, because I am counting on a hot summer. First of all, I believe it's going to be a hot summer in the Midwest. Now, you guys know my weather predictions are crazy, but I am sticking to this one because I just have a feeling that we are going to have a barn burner. And I love barn burner summers. Nothing makes me happier than a super hot, hot, hot summer. And what is a hot summer? Well, a hot summer is that, you know, it was warm early. Like, we had a really nice May. We had, most of May has been warm. Now it's wet and 50s and 60s now, but apparently it's going to get up in the 80s this weekend. We're going to have some storms. If it's going to be a genuinely hot summer, we should see high 80s consistently and maybe even into some 90s in the first couple of weeks of June. Now, to contrast that, I remember, I'm trying to think when my son was two. So he was born in 91. So in 93, we had a really cold, wet summer. And I remember going up to the lake in June because it was a weekend thing. And we took him up to the lake after school was out. So I think he was in first or second grade. Maybe even he was like two or three. So he couldn't have been in second grade. So I don't know what we were doing up there. But we went up and it was like, I want to say it was July 4th. I think it might have been July 4th weekend. It was cold and rainy. And it had been cold and rainy from May on. It never got warm that summer. The whole summer, it just never got warm. And I will contrast that with summers where your front lawn is burned. It just burns away. The front lawn, you go out there in your bare feet and you step on the grass and it kind of crinkles under your feet. I just love that. And July 4th is, you know, the fourth or fifth week of 80 plus temperatures. I remember one really, really hot summer when I had to take something over to Rice Lake. I had to take a three-wheeler to get fixed over in Rice Lake, Wisconsin. And that was around the 4th of July. And it was 105 degrees. 105 degrees by the thermometer. Well, maybe it wasn't that warm. It was like 101 in Rice Lake at noon when I took this thing to Rice Lake. And it's just, there was no breeze. The trees were not moving. It was utterly dead and just hot as blazes. And I remember I came back and I parked the truck and I ran down to the lake and just jumped in the water. And the water was like, the lake water was like bath water. That is a hot summer. And I'm hoping so much that we have that kind of a hot summer where, you know, as the sun is going down, you're sitting out on the dock and the water is absolutely still. There's no air and it's just hot, 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 hot. And you're sweating. I just love that. Now, Minnesotans, as a rule, really don't like cold. I mean, they would prefer a cold summer, I think, but I'll take a hot summer any day. They're just the best. They're classic summers, and I can't wait for this one. And that's my prediction for the weather, El Nino or not. Definitely want to thank xgovernmentcars.com for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcasts. Don't forget that xgovernmentcars.com has that great financing where everybody gets approved, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and they got great one-owner, professionally maintained government and fleet vehicles. In plain language, these cars are just kick-ass, okay? Check out what they got at xgovernmentcars.com, and thanks, Ed, for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcasts.
xgovernmentcars.com.
I got to thank Mad Case Studios for being the digital sponsor of the Bob Davis podcast, creating quality original automotive artwork. Mad K is going to be out at some of the antique auto shows this summer, and I'll tell you more as we get closer to the events, as will the Mobile Podcast Command Studio. And don't forget, Mobile Podcast Command will also be at the Iowa Straw Poll on August 8th of 2015. Click on the banners for more information about all the sponsors at thebobdavispodcast.com. Thank you for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, or TuneIn. Look at the brand new TuneIn player that Mitch and I loaded up to the BobDavisPodcast.com the other night. It's super cool. And also check out the picture of Mobile Podcast Command just under the big yellow donate button. I am saving up fuel for diesel to go to the EAA show in Eau Claire. Also, the straw poll, as I mentioned, in Iowa on August 8th, and some of the car shows around town. So click on that donate button. You can donate a dollar or 50 or 5 500 or as much as you want. I'll take it in the donate button area right underneath the picture of the podcast ambulance. That is safe and secure as well through PayPal. And thank you for liking, sharing, favoriting, and following on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I'm BDavis7843 on Instagram. And thanks for your donations again at thebobdavispodcast.com. Thanks for listening to Podcast 369, The New Talk, The Bob Davis Podcasts.
Hey, the cotton lord, cotton's high.